Welcome to another Flopcast. It's Derek here on my own this evening. So, with John and Scott being tied up for a few bits and pieces, I decided to try and grab an interview with Daniel Freeb, author, journalist, podcaster, TV presenter. The man can't turn his hand to anything. So it's been a podcast that I've been trying to organise since before the year, but myself and Dan, our times never synced up, but I eventually got him there last week. So, we have a long chat about his time at MAPA, Future Bits and Pieces. There's some really good insight into his time there. And I hope you enjoy this podcast. And let us know if you want to get in contact or if there's any feedback. Give me a shout back on Twitter at Flamcast. So, Dan, I'm really interested in your backstory. And I suppose I want to kind of explore the journalism thing. Because when I read a lot of stuff, there isn't much depth in around how the journalist got stuck into cycling. So how did a guy who was doing the modern languages degree end up doing PR for MAPE?
Well, I wasn't exactly doing PR, but we'll get to that in a minute. So I think it was quite a conventional route into cycling back then. I mean, if you look at the guys, certainly English-speaking journalists who are still covering cycling and were back then, I think quite a lot of us got into it through a similar route. I think William Fotheringham did Russian at university, Matt Rendell was certainly a linguist, and I learned French at school. You know, it was probably the thing I was best at school, and I'd gone on holiday to Italy when I was sort of 14, 15, and had completely fallen in love with it. Sort of simultaneously, had become passionate about Italian football, was like a lot of people in my generation, really loved the Channel 4 Football Italia. And I started teaching myself Italian, and a bit of a misspent sort of adolescence. I enrolled in sort of evening classes when all my mates were going out and meeting girls and drinking. I was learning Italian. So that was sort of happening. And then at the same time, I had always been crazy about sports. Both my parents were PE teachers. My dad didn't go on to become a PE teacher, but he had qualified and done his training as a PE teacher. And I'd played a lot of football, played a lot of cricket, played a lot of golf mainly. But I was sort of falling out of love with golf. My dad thought I was going to be the next Tiger Woods. That unfortunately didn't look like it was going to happen when I got to about 12, 13. And I suppose cycling became my sort of act of rebellion, really. I got into it quite late. First really became aware of it when we were on sort of family holidays to France, and it kind of be flickering on the TV in the background. And my dad knew a few names. I remember the tour when Pascal Lino was in the yellow jersey. My dad seemed to be aware that a Frenchman was in the yellow jersey, and we sort of watched a few minutes. And then I think maybe a bit more in sort of 1995. And then 1996 was really the first one I watched. I'd got a mountain bike for my birthday, and started going out on sort of, you know, reasonable size rides, sort of 15 kilometers, 20 kilometers, 30 kilometers, just kind of on my own and then with a friend from school. And then it started to sort of escalate. And parallel to that, back then, if you didn't speak foreign languages, then a lot of professional cycling was quite sort of impenetrable. But because I was learning the French and the Italian, they were a sort of window into that world. And very quickly, within a couple of years, I got pretty sort of obsessed with it. I mean, it's kind of like, well, it was back then. I think now it's a lot more mainstream. But back then, it was kind of like being the kid at school who's into a very sort of strange kind of sub-branch of, you know, punk rock, or, you know, in my case, I was very into hip-hop, but sort of it felt kind of different and underground, and it was very much my thing, and I sort of buried myself in it. So, yeah, that was that. I did French A-level, German A-level, and then I was, you know, my Italian was getting good in the meantime, and I decided I was going to do French and Italian at university. The other thing was that my dad, having been, as I said, qualified as a PE teacher, he actually went on to work in ceramics. And he had dealings with Mappe. Not many dealings, but he knew of them. And we were invited, I were invited to the Leeds Classic in 1996, sort of hospitality kind of thing. And we went up there, and that just sort of deepened this growing passion I had for cycling. And then when I was about to go to university it was actually the end of my first year at university, the summer holidays, I wanted to go and spend some time in Italy, and through contacts at Mappe, I managed to sort of get a bit of a kind of work experience at Mappe that summer. So I did the summer of, I think, 2000 at Mappe. And then, of course, I was going to have a year abroad because I was doing modern languages at university, and you could either work or study in a year abroad. And I decided that I wanted to go back to Mappe. So I went and worked in the marketing department at Mappe, and I was actually translating, editing their internal magazine, which really didn't have a lot to do with cycling. It was to do with the
business.
The company's other activities. But because, you know, the cycling team was the pride and joy of the company, and I was also kind of working alongside Dr. Squincy's wife, Dottoressa Spazzoli. She was sort of headed up the marketing department. That was kind of my department. So I had a lot of contact with the team, team-related activities. Not so much the rides themselves, but, you know, things like in 2001, I can remember being sort of party to and in on the conversations about the jersey design for the following year, and kind of Dottoressa Spazzoli very kindly kind of asked me sort of what I thought, you know, whether they should go with design A, design B, design C. So in a kind of sort of tenuous way, I was sort of instrumental in them picking that last, I don't know whether it's the most sort of memorable of the Mappe jerseys, but probably the most garish of all of them, the dark blue one that was completely covered in the blocks. That was sort of, I kind of chose that, or helped me choose it.
I don't know whether that's praise or blame that should be given to you there. But I've actually got my member edition of Rouleur here beside me with the cover that has that jersey on it.
There you go.
How did you find that? Was it what you wanted, or did it just kind of engage you more to be, cycling is where I want to go? Or I presume it must have been a surreal experience being that it kind of dropped into Mappe, and how integrated the team was with the business and how integrated the business was with the team.
Yeah, I mean, for me, it was a dream. I mean, there was such a strong sort of cycling culture and culture of interest in the company, and the history of Mappe and the history of Milan, really, in the north of Italy, is a real sort of a kind of blue collar sort of story, success story. And one of the things that I loved about the cycling culture in sort of France and Italy, which I found was very different from what it was in the UK, and it's probably even more different from the cycling culture in the UK now, is that there it was a kind of working class sort of culture. It was, you know, a lot of the same guys who were interested in sort of, I'm talking about fans now, they'd also be interested in football, and they were quite sort of humble, modest guys, and the professionals were sort of from humble, modest backgrounds. And at the company itself, there was obviously, you know, there's a big sort of innovation culture, and a lot of the success of Mappe has come from its innovation. And but also there was obviously a big kind of manufacturing arm and manufacturing element to it. And I had met or been put into contact with, you know, a lot of the guys who kind of worked in the factory at Mappe, or who were working for the company on that level, who were cyclists. And that became my riding group at Mappe. So we would go out. There was a huge group that used to meet outside the park in Monza, where the F1 circuit is. And, you know, sometimes I never rode with him, but it was also where sort of Gianni Bugno would go out for his weekend rides. He'd retired. But there was, you know, sometimes you turn up outside the park in Monza and there'd be 150 guys there, and people would sort of go off in then different groups. But we had this Mappe group, and And, you know, I was riding with these older guys, sort of middle-aged guys, a lot of them, who worked for MAPE, and they would all be completely kitted out head to toe in MAPE gear. And often, you know, at the end of the season, they would have the opportunity to buy, you know, the old equipment that the team had been using. So quite a lot of them were on sort of old team bikes. And, you know, and this for me was, this was heaven. This was absolutely, you know, fantastic. And we'd go out and, you know, I think I'd had no exposure really to like the club scene in the UK, because I'd sort of discovered cycling on my own and carried on doing it on my own. And you know, gradually I'd sort of got more and more serious, and I'd got a road bike and then another road bike. And then I'd come home from school and I would ride on the turbo train every night after school, and then at weekends I'd go on my own. And so it was all kind of on my own. But then when I got to Italy, I was sort of immersed in this, you know, what was like, I suppose, the equivalent of the club culture there. And I guess it was quite different. I mean, what we would do, we'd sort of ride out from Monza towards the mountains, towards Como, usually that kind of area. And, you know, there would be a climb, basically one big climb on the program, and everyone would sort of ride together. And no one would really seem to know where we were going. There'd be one guy who'd decide the route, always the same guy. And then word would sort of go back in the group, in the chain gang, of which climb we were doing today. And you would, depending on how hard the climb was, whether it was the Ghisallo or something else, people would start to sort of fan off and decide that they didn't fancy it that day. And they'd bugger off and they'd do their own route. But anyway, you get to the bottom of this climb, and then we'd sort of race the climb. And I was quite a decent climber. And, you know, I used to absolutely adore these rides. And you'd get to the top of the climb and then you'd stop at a fountain. No cafe stops, cake stops, nothing like that. You'd literally wait for the last guy to get to the fountain. And then you'd sort of race back to Milan together, but it would turn into a bit of a... ride back to Milan together, but it would actually turn into a bit of a race. People sort of flexing their muscles. And you know, you'd end up doing 120, 130 kilometres. And that was the sort of group riding. That was the only group riding I'd ever known. And I suppose it was only, you know, later when I became a bit more aware of, you know, sort of club culture in Britain, which I never really participated in, that I realised it was maybe quite different in Italy.
Yeah, you were definitely spoiled there with that sort of, that amount of riders, that sort of group. That quality of group and that quality of, I suppose, climbs, roads, area that you're riding in, that sounds like heaven to everyone.
Yeah, and also I noticed how different it was, because then I went and lived in France for 6 months in Avignon, and the groups there were completely different. In it was kind of a lot more like French pros at the time had the reputation of just, you know, attacking gratuitously, annoyingly at any point in a race. And it was kind of the same on the group rides in France. You would sort of go out going incredibly slowly, like too slowly sort of for my taste, but then someone would think it was kind of funny, or, you know, a good laugh, good fun, to just have a sort of dig just on a completely random part of the route, you know, after 10 kilometers or 20 kilometers or 30 kilometers, and they would just sort of sprint for a kilometre or two, and everyone would have to chase him, and then everyone would have a good laugh, and then no one would do anything for half an hour again. And it was kind of, it was frustrating, really.
Yeah.
And it did kind of, you know, what I'd always heard about the, you know, we still hear it sometimes. I think it doesn't necessarily apply anymore, and there are good reasons for that. But you always used to hear about Italian racing, that it used to follow a quite a set pattern, that it would be easy in the first hour, slightly harder in the second hour, and it would gradually sort of crank up. And I think the historical reason for that, or what I've been told, is that Italian races always used to finish with circuits around towns. You know, often Italian towns are, well, the hilltop towns, and the real racing would take place there, but the race would start somewhere else outside the town. So the first hour or two until you got to the town would be a bit of a procession, and then it would sort of crank up towards the end. And that was what those group rides were like.
After you spent your time there, did you go back to MAPE at a later stage again? Or am I...
Well, so I was there twice. I was there, once in the summer 2000, and then the 2002, So I was there for, you know, 6 or 9 months in 2002, but also 2001 to 2002. And then after that, so I'd come back after that first summer where I'd been to MAPE. I was studying at UCL, University College London, and the main campus there is on Gower Street, which was about 500 meters from the Pro Cycling Magazine offices. Pro Cycling Magazine was launched in 1999, and we're talking 2000, end of 2000 now. And I wrote, when I came back from MAPE that first time, I wrote a sort of spontaneous email to the editor, Jeremy Whittle at the time, sort of saying, oh, you know, I'm really interested in maybe writing journalism, and I've just, you know, I speak Italian, I speak French, and I've just done this, you know, had this summer working for MAPE. And, you know, he wrote back and said, come in, have a chat. And I did. And I was very soon, they were sort of getting me in for a couple of days, 3 days a week, and for a few hours a day. But I, of course, wanted more. And I probably ended up, well, I did end up completely sort of overcommitting. I mean, the next year was just spent sprinting from the Pro Cycling office back to university, back to Pro Cycling office, back to, and it completely, well, it almost finished me off, really. But, you know, within a few weeks of being at Pro Cycling, I was sort of writing cover features. The first cover feature they got me to do was, sent me off to see Gilberto Simoni at his house in Italy. You know, because as is the case now in the media, as soon as you find anyone who's sort of willing to work for, you know, at that time I wasn't asking them for any money or not much money, you know, and I was willing, and, you know, they thought I was just about able to do it. So I was sort of very much thrown in at the deep end, and I carried on doing that really for the rest of my degree. And then when I finished my degree in 2003, it was pretty obvious that to me that that's what I should probably do. Or, yeah, it was definitely a good option to go into that and try and make some kind of career in that.
It's an amazing start to a story, because it if someone told me that if I read that in a book, I wouldn't believe it, that you went off, taught yourself Italian, then went and, you know, got work experience at MAPE, and your college was 500 meters from a new cycling magazine that had just opened. It kind of partially sounds unbelievable, but you know, hearing it from you, it does sound real. When you started into it, did you think the landscape has changed so much from MAPE then to what we have now? And even if you look at the engagement MAPE had between its team and its business, I don't really see that anymore between any of the teams. To a lesser extent, maybe EF and Rafa, but they're less of a business and more of a sponsor kind of thing, and that engagement is a bit different. But I don't see that kind of engagement between team and sponsor or team and owner anymore. And do you think that it could come back anytime?
I don't know. I mean, you know, the whole landscape of the sport has just changed so much. And you know, you have to say it's changed for the better, really. I mean, you look back at the history of those years and, you know, what was going on. And it was, you know, a lot of it was pretty sinister, really. You know, with all we know now about the doping that was happening then, you know, I think the thing that really strikes me hard as well, and I think maybe people don't acknowledge enough, or they don't really realise, is how much demographically it's changed, or socio-demographically, particularly in the UK. You know, I talk about the sort of the kind of people who are interested in cycling in Italy and you know, France and those countries before, and you compare that with, you know, what is now really, especially in the UK, an upper middle class sport and a mainstream sport. You know, I mean, I'm becoming aware just over the last few weeks, I've been becoming aware of some of the British guys and the number of British riders who are sort of turning pro in the next few months or are kind of moving up to like big under 23 teams. And which suggests to me, you know, the sheer quantity suggests to me that it's become something that is quite common to do for teenagers now. And a lot of them have been exposed to races. And you know, as I said, back in the day, you were an absolute oddity. I mean, you tried to sort of explain to people what this sport was, that you're interested in it, why you're interested in it. And you know, it never occurred to you that people would know what you were talking about, really. And they never would. And, you know, I mean, I grew up near, well, it was sort of between Coventry and Birmingham. And I said I used to cycle alone. I mean, that was partly, you know, partly what I liked about it, really. It was sort of an escape. It was almost a kind of meditation. But I don't think I would have really had much choice. I mean, I could have joined a club, but otherwise you just didn't see cyclists out on the road. There was no one that you would kind of, you'd turn around, there'd be someone on your wheel and you'd do 10 kilometers together or whatever. It just never happened. There was just no one riding their bikes. And then the whole sort of club scene, and the whole bike shop scene never really appealed to me. They seemed like these kind of, you know, sort of eccentric, skinny, bald, sort of pretty unfashionable, unapproachable blokes who were very sort of snobbish. If you didn't know how to ride in a bunch, if you didn't know, you know, what derailleur to ask for in a bike shop, or they would sort of look down their nose at you. So like, that never really appealed to me. I was sort of preoccupied with this kind of fantasy world that I knew existed in Italy and France, where they were kind of normal people rode bikes. So, you know, that's just changed beyond recognition. And then on a professional level, you know, the biggest change, I suppose, well, you know, apart from if we talk about sort of doping and that kind of culture, but the other big change is just kind of linguistically, and how English has just taken over, really. And, you know, it was this world that was completely impenetrable, really, if you didn't speak foreign languages before. You know, the idea that a Giancarlo Ferretti or a Manolo Saiz, the kind of guys that I would, you know, I sort of had to nervously approach in my first couple of tours and races, and, you know, speak to in their languages, the idea that they would have spoken English, I mean, it was just, you know, it never crossed your mind.
Yeah, and I suppose just coming from that as well, like, I've been helping a guy, he's an Irish guy from Australia, and he's been riding in Belgium for the last couple of years, and now he's going to an Italian team. And just the accessibility that he can contact so many people, and
yeah,
everything is so much closer these days, whereas formerly, before, you'd have to know the former ex-pro who'd put you in contact with someone who might know the equivalent of Tim Harris in Belgium, or an Italian Tim Harris or whatever else. And that's the stream you'd have to go through. Now the knowledge is everywhere for everyone to try and get through. I suppose, do you think your story would have been different if you landed up in Belgium instead of Italy?
I'm not really sure. I mean, Italy was where sort of my, and to a lesser extent France, was where my sort of passion lay. I'm not really sure, to be honest, Derek.
No, it's just because I suppose you landed in an unbelievable place with an unbelievable culture at the time, and I wonder if the Belgian culture would have kind of maybe put you off, or would have been a bit more different, or would have been like the French culture that was just, it didn't suit your style or didn't kind of interest you. But I suppose, yeah, it's all cycling at the same time. I suppose just going back to, we've spoken about this before, going back to Mappy and stuff like that, I was kind of tuned out of cycling at this stage around 00. I was doing my growing up, kind of turned my back on it. But you were around VDB and a few more of them. I don't mean that you were best mates with him, but you would have been around cycling and seen him. How much of a loss was someone like that to the sport?
I mean, it's difficult to, it's just difficult to sort of process, you know, the sort of human toll that the sport took in those years. I mean, my first experience with Vandenbroek wasn't at Mappe. It was in 2001. I think it was 2001. One of the first gigs I did for pro cycling was I went to a training camp for Lamprey, and he just signed for Lamprey, and I actually rode with the team that day. And he sort of abandoned the group ride that day, and it was a big drama that day in the team, that they just signed this guy and they were going to relaunch him, and he hadn't even finished the group ride, and he'd sort of peeled off from the group and not said anything, and then he was just back at the hotel. And I had to interview him later that day, and he was just very sort of sulky and evasive, and I didn't really know what had gone on, and I don't think the team managers or the team members had knew you know what was going on. I mean, I think piecing it all together with hindsight, he was probably in a pretty dark place in that period in 2001. It wasn't a good year for him at all, and his sort of addictions had kind of had taken hold and would escalate over the next 2 or 3 years. And then the last experience I had with him was a week or two before he died, in the 2009 World Championships in Mendrisio. He was there as a journalist, and he'd done a few interviews over the week, and I sort of left it to the last minute to interview him. So I interviewed him, sort of was the last person to interview him at that Worlds that he was working on as a journalist in 2009 Mendrisio. And we talked all about how he'd sort of conquered his demons and how everything was going well. And he'd finally got this sort of love of his life, Sara, this Italian girl he'd sort of lost his head over, and he'd had a child with. He'd finally got her out of his system, and he was no longer taking cocaine and so forth. And then he died 2 weeks later. So, it's difficult to sort of reconcile, you know, those couple of sort of intimate experiences I had with him with, you know, the story of what happened. And I suppose, you know, that applies to a few of those guys in that era, you know, with Pantani and you know, Ulrich, who obviously is, you know, thankfully still alive. But I don't know. I suppose you've got the two-dimensional story of you know, of it being written down on paper and the results, and you knowing them as a rider, and then sometimes it's quite difficult to connect that to actual kind of visceral feelings and the sort of 3D real human drama that's happening. I think, unfortunately, to be honest, we've become a bit numb and a bit brutalized and a bit world weary, and we did, and we have, about a lot of what was happening in those years. And you know, I think I'm sometimes guilty of this. You know, you sort of tell these stories about the blood transfusions and everything that was going on, and you're a little bit blasé about it.
Yeah, it's funny because I suppose in my job, I've got lots of people that are involved with different sports teams and stuff like that. And, you know, whenever a doping story comes up in the press, I can speak to, you know, blood doping transfusions. You can easily speak about diuretics and masking agents. And it's only recently that I realized people are looking at you and you're going, how in God's name do you know all this? Mm. And it's just, it's like that. It's just, it's kind of common knowledge if you're around cycling with a number of years, if you've seen these years, that you can speak to this sort of topic and you can speak quite well and almost as if you are a doctor. But, you know, look, you're familiar with the terminology, you understand how stuff works. And it's only when someone afterwards, when someone come up to me and said, how do you know all this? Oh, well, I've been around cycling since, you know, the late 80s and stuff like that. And, you know, you just be familiar with these sort of stories and what stuff means and what stuff doesn't mean. And it does kind of shatter some illusions that other people and other sports are not at all familiar with it, or not at all familiar with the cost of it, or not at all familiar with the human element of it. And I suppose just the other point that you were making about VDB, like, it's these days we look to box off people, you know, that he was a bad person or he was this type of person, that's the box we put him in, we file that person under that. And it's, you know, it's the same in some way, shape, or for the likes of Armstrong, and we just like to, you know, box him off, and that's that. And it's for our own kind of defense mechanisms and our own reality of dealing with that sort of era. And like you said, then when you talk about it, you know, you can just relate the stories about, you know, the story even about Rico, you know, storing his old blood and it going off and stuff like that. And we talk about those stories as if, you know, they're not shocking. And it's just, it's the cyclist manner of dealing with stuff. And it's strange, I suppose, and it's not nice because they are people at the end of the day, and there's human costs involved. You know, there was the love of his life involved there. There was a child involved and stuff like that. And it doesn't, none of the stories ever see that anymore, do they?
No, and you know, sometimes I think maybe, you know, I'm too brutalized, not world, well, too world weary, and not morally prudish enough anymore. I mean, I look at the reaction to, for example, the Salazar story in Athletics at the moment, and you know, I can understand why people, that, you know, there were comments made by, I think, Paula Radcliffe, and to be honest, I didn't follow it that closely, but I saw that she was being hammered. And I think people, you know, have maybe got legitimate doubts about her performances, and it's all, you know, it's all put in that context, and people think that she's got away with things. But, you know, she was basically saying, I mean, I think she said it very clumsily, but she was sort of saying, well, isn't, you know, what he's been accused of in the grand scheme of things on the sort of Armstrong spectrum, or, you know, yeah, on the cycling spectrum, is not that bad. And sometimes you do catch yourself feeling the same thing. I mean, which is not to say that he shouldn't have been banned, and to not to say that, you know, he shouldn't be punished and people shouldn't be upset about it. But sometimes the shrillness of the outrage, to me, it either seems, well, it seems disingenuous, or it seems to be the sort of fruit of a mentality of people who have not really been paying attention for the last 20 or 30 years. But some people still seem to have the same reflex they had when Ben Johnson tested positive in 1987, that, you know, doping was tantamount to, it's akin to murder, that it's the most mortal sin, it's the most heinous crime you could possibly imagine. And, you know, we've seen over the last 20 or 30 years that, A, it's been rife in certain sports, and, you know, there are undeniably different degrees of it. And sometimes I think the shrillness has come about because the sort of authorities and the way it's legislated now make us think that it is
the worst crime
possible. But as soon as you know, if you start talking about giving people 4-year bans and life bans, that sends the message that it kind of is tantamount to murder, when what it really is cheating. It's cheating in the same way that, you know, different, as I said, completely different degrees, but cheating in the same way that diving in football is cheating. It's cheating in the same way as, you know, claiming a catch in cricket when you know that the batsman hasn't edged it is cheating. But, you know, people do put it in a completely different category, which, you know, maybe I struggle with this sometimes. I think, you know, maybe that's what it requires for it to be eradicated, that it becomes a complete taboo, that no one will ever contemplate it because they know the outrage and they know the shame that will come, and they know that, you know, their career will be over if they're caught. Maybe that is the deterrent you need. But then the problem with that is that if then people do err, and humans do err, and they do make mistakes, then if they're then subjected to that shame, then bad things can happen. And we saw that with that generation. I mean, I often think that guys, like, the difference between a Pantani and an Armstrong is that Pantani was a more sensitive guy, and he had a thinner skin, and, you know, he had qualities that we would usually consider in life in general to be more desirable than, you know, the thick skin, the thicker skin that maybe someone like an Armstrong had, or but that led to his downfall. You know, he had to live with that shame, and it hurt him. You know, it's not as though he was caught, whatever he said in the press about, you know, he thought he was innocent. I think he probably internalized a lot of the shame, and I think it probably made it hard for him to look in the mirror, look himself in the mirror after what happened.
Yeah, his moral compass probably caused a spiral, which increased because of his moral compass, which increased because of his moral compass as a spiral.
Yeah,
yeah.
I mean, with speculation, but I often do wonder about that.
Yeah, and I suppose, have you ever read anything by John Ronson about that sort of stuff as well?
Yeah, yeah.
It's a very interesting area, and I suppose I do think that it needs, something like this needs carrot and stick approach. I do agree that in some respects that there needs to be a severe sentence, but at the same time, if you look at someone again like Rico, for instance, if he should have been put into rehab, most probably the same with Jan Ullrich at some point early on after a couple of offences. Because you're not, banning a person like that is, you're looking at the end result. You're not looking at the causation of it. And if someone has addiction, if someone has addictive personality traits, if someone has destructive personality traits, again, looking at Pantani, he may not have had the skill set to cope with what he was experiencing or what was being punished, he was being punished for. So, you know, like, we just ban the person and expect them to get on with it and deal with it. And you can turn around and then, you know, you get people that come out the far end of that, Valverde, Armstrong, stuff like that, and it, you know, they just don't blink. And that's just their mindset and their abilities, and as you said, their thick skin. But then some people don't have those skill sets. So in some way, shape or form, we have to deal with the human cost of that. And whether that is that, right, look, you need to go to rehab, you need to do this 12-step program, we need to see you have this completed before we can lift, you know, your 2 years is up. And I do think that there needs to be carrot and stick for that sort of stuff to try and resolve the human aspect of it, rather than just, oh, it's a sporting offence, you're gone.
Yeah, and you know, if you compare sort of the decade of riders, the, you know, riders who were active in the 90s, and the number of them that had problems, the number of them that had addictions, the number of them that have died, and you compare that to say the 60s when Merckx was around, when at a time when riders were being banned 2 weeks and they were coming back, and there was very little press coverage. I mean, newspapers would report a positive test, but there would be none of this sort of public hand wringing. Well, you know, those riders, there weren't many of those riders that subsequently became cocaine addicts or you know, committed suicide, or you know, it wasn't comparable, which makes you think that you know, the reason that we've had Pantanis and Chava Jimenez and the Vandenbroeks, it wasn't the drugs themselves. It was that shame that was brought about by being sort of, you know, held up to ridicule and scorn, and that was what they couldn't deal with. And you know, as I say, it's a very difficult one. I don't think anyone's necessarily got all the right answers, because you don't want to, you do want strong deterrence. But as you say, I think you have to also think about, you know, what comes next if people do make mistakes.
Speaking, let's try and lighten this a little bit. Speaking of the worst offences in cycling ever, what about getting banned for cheating in indoor cycling?
Well, I don't really have any sort of strong moral feelings about that, but I'm kind of intrigued by the whole thing. I don't have any, I mean, I see a lot of people sort of absolutely ridiculing it and rubbishing it online. I don't really feel inclined to do that. I'm just sort of curious about it and intrigued by it. I mean, I haven't had the time yet to really get a better handle on exactly what's involved. I mean, I haven't used Zwift myself. Maybe I'll do it at some point in the future, but yeah.
Do you think esports has a place in cycling going forward in the future?
I think it probably does. I'm not particularly interested, Derek. I mean, one of the things that I think I said this on our podcast a few weeks ago, one of the really fascinating things about cycling, one of the great things about cycling, is that everyone's interest is a kind of pie chart. And for some people, you know, the 20% of the pie chart is to do with sort of physiology and or you know, mechanics, or the, you know, pedaling mechanics, and another 30% is, you know, the team aspect and all the intrigue, and then the 50% is the fantastic places it visits and so forth and so on. And for some people, that a big part of that pie chart will be the kind of thing that Zwift gives them, i.e. you know, numbers, the social aspect of it as well, because there is a big social aspect of Zwift, what I gather. Those elements of cycling are not necessarily the biggest shares of my pie chart, so it's not something that was ever going to really appeal to me. I mean, it may be that one day I'll have to cover it as part of my job. That hasn't happened yet, but
touch wood quickly.
Yeah.
No, I can see it becoming a bigger aspect, like, you know, I suppose with the Canyon SRAM trials and stuff like that, this is their second or third year running it, that they're getting academy riders from it, and you know, it's taken it's taken a big slice out of motorsports as well. If you look at Renault have run a program, there's another number of different companies have run programs to find drivers and stuff like that, and they have translated into real world. So it's going to be interesting to see where it goes. And I suppose, again, just another little jokey one. Worst cycling offense ever. The Niels Ekhoff, he's gone to CAS to appeal his world championship disqualification. Do you think he'll go anywhere? The under 23 rider, the under 23 rider that got banned or got disqualified.
Oh, that's a tricky one as well. I mean, whether you know, CAS and cycling have an interesting history, and it sort of waxed and waned, the kind of relationship with the UCI and UCI sanctions over the years. I mean, there was a period, and again, it was mainly to do with doping, when there was a lot of sort of back and forth between CAS and UCI, but they're not had to interact that much, as far as I know. Over the last few years, there haven't been a lot of cases that have gone to CAS, having, you know, previously been adjudicated by the UCI. So, you know, a lot with that depends on the individual, the judges that CAS appoints, and you know, how, I don't know how much money, Neil Eckhoff, isn't it?
Yep.
I don't know much, you know, money he's got to throw at the problem. As with a lot of legal cases, that's often a factor as well. I don't know how much the Dutch Federation are going to get behind him, but it might come down to that. As far as the actual nuts and bolts of the case are concerned, I think what it taught us was that there needs to be a bit more clarity. The riders themselves don't really know, you
Yeah.
know, how long they're allowed to shelter behind cars, when exactly they're allowed to shelter behind cars. You know, I mean, I saw it happen in real time. Then I watched the video afterwards, and having watched the video of him behind the car for 2 minutes, I started to think one thing, but then listened to a lot of pro riders' opinions, and maybe again start to come down from that position a little bit, which I think probably illustrates that it's a pretty thorny issue.
Yeah, it kind of is a 50p coin. Like, there's lots of sides to it. I suppose I've DS'd, and I've looked after amateur riders and stuff like that, and I've done a bit of riding myself. And like I said, if my DS didn't do that for me, he'd get an awful bollocking from me at the end of the race. You know, and if as a DS you wouldn't do it yourself, you know, you'd expect a bollocking from your rider. But yeah, I suppose the only kind of outstanding thing that I could see from it was that there was a commissar there beside him, and he never gave a warning. And normally, 8 times out of 10, the comm would give you a warning. And I think
Yeah.
that may be the only legal loophole he has. So, you know, I think.
My issue with all of this is, you know, you're talking about a set of, which we always do in cycling, you're talking about a set of conventions, what actually happens on the road.
Yeah,
None
the.
of this is written in the rule book. None of
No.
this, you know, that you are allowed for a certain amount of time, or, I mean, the only thing that is written is, you know, about warnings. But, you know, there really needs to be a pretty rigid protocol that everyone knows and everyone can consult, and doesn't change from season to season. But that's what mystifies me, really. I mean, the riders, you know, the consensus seems to be pretty solid that, you know, it should be allowed. It is effectively permitted most of the time. But the fact is that's not written in the rule book.
No, the rule is sheltering behind or taking advantage of the slipstream of a vehicle. One day race, 200 fine per infringement. Driver, 500 fine per infringement. And in addition to the above provisions, in serious cases, in case of repeated infringement or aggravating circumstances, the commissaires panel may eliminate or disqualify a rider and or exclude a license holder. And again, it's like all UCI rules. It's just grey enough to cover themselves.
Well, there's no mention of time, there's no mention of distance from the car, you know, there's no mention of crashes or mechanicals. So, you know, it's incredibly oblique, isn't it?
It is, yeah. Do you ever think the UCI will get the rule book in somewhat of a decent order that we might actually enjoy the sport?
Yeah, I mean, sometimes I'm loath to criticize the UCI, because, you know, I think nowadays anyone who doesn't, and I see it on social media, people who don't have, or entities that don't have a strong social media presence and don't interact with people, and seem like faceless organizations, just seem to get criticized, indiscriminately sometimes. But, you know, governing body is obviously restricted in this, you know, it can't interact, it can't sort of
be
answerable to the public about
it can't be your mate
decision.
It can't be your mate on Twitter.
No. No, but then you know, there are other things the UCI do that sort of worry you. And obviously, you know, the UCI's recent history, or history of the last 20, 30 years, and the sort of blurred lines between promoter and policeman are slightly troubling.
Yeah, and they're getting more troubling now with, you know, the way they've treated track cycling. I know. Maybe not you're not the biggest fan of it, but
no.
The way they're starting to treat track cycling, the way they're starting to treat cyclocross as well, it does look as if it's ASO by stealth.
Yeah. And, you know, just this role that it's created for itself and is pursuing as a race organizer, or effectively acting like a race organizer. I think that needs to be, you know, established. Where the sort of remit of a federation and essentially an organizer ends, and that of a race organizer and private entity begins.
Yeah. Let's lighten it up again. I got a few questions on Twitter before I Skyped you. So I did say that I was talking to a cappuccino expert.
Yeah. I don't know where this has come from. I'm actually not that fastidious about coffee, but anyway, go on.
I don't know where it started from as well. I suppose the first question is, 11 a.m. really the cutoff, or is it 12 o'clock?
It's 11 or 12. A lot of it depends on the
region,
the weather.
Oh.
But yeah, the region and the weather. I think when it's colder, so if you go to places like Milan in winter, you will see people having a cappuccino up until midday. More up until midday, but almost never after that. I would say never. And in the sort of summer months, it's quite rare after 11 o'clock, I would say.
The next one is a macchiato acceptable past the cappuccino hour?
Yes.
Ooh.
No real rules on that. No real rules. Some people prefer to have a macchiato, well, it's just their drink instead of an espresso. So anytime you're thinking of having an espresso, a macchiato is also acceptable.
Oh, interesting. And the final one, and you love this one, what is speed golf actually about?
It's the future. Speed golf is the future. It's been a barren year for me on the speed golf front, because haven't played in any tournaments. I was supposed to play in the French Open, but it clashed with, well, I was going to actually exit the Giro for a few hours and go and play in Chamonix in speed golf, French speed golf open. But I need a sponsor, Derek, because it was gonna cost me about €1,000 between the Mont Blanc tunnel and hiring a car and so on and so forth. So I didn't, my budget couldn't stretch to that. But speed golf is, well, it's playing golf as quickly as you can, which includes running between shots. And the score at the end of the round is your time in minutes plus your number of shots. And decent performance, decent rounds should, you know, if you're a decent player, should take you around 45, 50 minutes, which is a bit better than the sort of 3, 4, 5 hours that it takes otherwise. But yeah, so it's a sport with massive potential. I'm hoping to get next year, hoping to play a few events, get a world ranking, and possibly play in the US Open next year.
Fantastic. We'll have to get Rafa to start making you some kit you'll soon be the first man playing speed golf in Lycra, because it'll help you. full-on skin suit and a time trial helmet or something like that, running between soles.
Absolutely. Not many cyclists have much time for golf. This is something I've noticed. There's not much crossover.
Yeah, I've got a couple of uncles that play off scratch, and I've got a few mates who play a bit. So yeah, there's a bit of crossover there. I suppose over here it's a bit different. There's have you played over here in Ireland a lot at all?
No.
Yeah, I suppose in a lot of places you can't move for golf courses. There's quite a lot of them over here, and it's quite a big tourist industry as well. So you would have a bit of crossover with a lot of people, you know, that golf would be another sport that he would play, or someone in the family would play a bit of golf. So it's familiar enough to us over here as well.
Yeah.
Dan, I'm going to leave you go because I know you need to get going at 10 o'clock, or sorry, 11 o'clock your time. Thank you for your time.
No worries. Thank you, Derek. Been a pleasure.